here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, there are trillions of stars in the sky, and we can learn something from all of them. We'll talk to a science writer who focused on 21 stars that changed our view of the universe. First, with vaccinations becoming a reality, many people are experiencing some relief. But COVID-19 has claimed more than 6,500 lives in the state. Projections show that hundreds more may die of the illness in the months ahead. Reporters at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel have been taking a look at the data, including reported cases and reported deaths, to try to understand who felt the biggest impact. And beyond the data, they looked at the grief and heartbreak that's become a part of many people's lives over the last year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there someone you'd like to remember on air that you've lost in the last year? Tell us a little bit about them. Or do you have questions about the data, the progress of the disease here in the state, the demographics of who was hit hardest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. John Diedrich is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was one of the reporters on this piece. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
This was a big look back, John, at the last year. Can you tell us what you and your colleagues set out to try to figure out?
Well, when we looked at the data, when this first surfaced as a major story a year ago, we were looking for trends that were developing, and we just didn't have, we tried to do this sort of instant analysis that we often do in the media, but until you have data, you really can't do that. So we were looking at a month, 2 months, and so forth. But as we stretched out to a year, we could see enough cases, enough deaths that happened to be more statistically significant. A couple trends that surfaced early was that we were seeing more deaths among older people who had underlying health conditions. More men were dying than women. There was a very sharp racial disparity early on. And then there was also this question of, was COVID-19 actually pulling deaths from other categories? And I'll explain what that means. Is it people who were already sick, say with heart disease or diabetes or cancer? And essentially, COVID would have been hastening their deaths, but they would have died anyway in that time. So those were the questions we set out to address.
And I want to start with that last question. It seems like we have a pretty solid answer on that when we look at the total number of deaths in the state and how they increased last year. What do we find out when we look at that?
Well, that's right. This is probably, in terms of a statistical finding, one of the most important pieces, because it does show very clearly in death data that we received from the state of Wisconsin that there was a large increase, statistically surprising by several fold from what had been happening in recent years, 16% increase. So in real numbers, that's about 8,400 people died in 2020 in Wisconsin, beyond what died the year before in 2019. That's a 16% increase. The reason that's significant is if you look at the increase in deaths in Wisconsin in recent years, it bounces around from like 1% to 2%. That's because of our aging population, baby boomers, and so forth. And what we could see is a clear increase above and beyond that 1% to 2% to 16%. And what's interesting is that COVID-19 was the third leading cause of death in Wisconsin behind heart disease and cancer last year. But there is also a series of deaths, 2,000 deaths, that really are not accounted for in the numbers. They're scattered around different categories. And in some cases, we don't know the cause of death because the paperwork hasn't been finished yet. And that could be a number of things. That could be undercounted COVID cases where tests were not available. It could be people not seeking care who were worried about going to the hospital, people with treatable chronic or emergency conditions. It could be related to the increase in suicide, homicide, and overdoses that we saw in 2020. So those are some of the, it's going to take some time to really tease out what all those numbers mean, but clearly there was an increase. And I should point out that that increase is been mirroring what we're seeing projected increases nationwide. But this data is very specific for Wisconsin and shows that there was a clear increase in death in 2020.
And speaking of specific data, something I didn't know until I read your piece, John, was that Milwaukee County had some of the closest watched and tabulated data really of any of the counties all over the country. Why is that?
Well, so the medical examiner here in Milwaukee, Brian Peterson, what medical examiners usually do is they look at things like homicides, accidental deaths, sort of surprise deaths, if you will, unattended deaths. And so they're not looking at cases like nursing home, where people who die in nursing homes, hospitals, that sort of thing. But they also are allowed to look when there's a public health crisis. And that's what Dr. Peterson decided to do early on. And it's interesting what he did is he took on a lot more cases. We have about 1,100 people who've died in Milwaukee County. But it's interesting, by reviewing the cases, his view is that some of the cases that others may be counting as COVID related or COVID caused, I should say, in other words, the cause of death was COVID, that he feels in his view, like 200 to 300 cases above the 1,100 cases were people who probably would have died anyway from other causes. And that he set that as COVID as an underlying condition that contributed to the death, but was not the cause of death. And so this sounds maybe a little bit like splitting hairs, but it is important because on death certificates, there is only one cause of death. It's a very old system that we have, and it's just the way it works. And so, but what Dr. Peterson has done is not only review all these cases, but he has released the documents related to that case. And so we see a deeper look at so sort of like underlying health conditions that are coming up most often in the cases of people who've died, their ages, more specifics about their cases. So that is a unique picture. We checked with the top 40 sized medical examiners around the country, and there was only one that was doing this sort of thing in California.
Talking to John Diedrich from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, investigative reporter there. He and his colleagues looked back on a year of COVID-19 information here in Wisconsin to see what communities were hit hardest, what demographics hit hardest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for John? Do you have a story to share maybe of someone in your own family you'd like to remember who passed away from COVID-19? You can join in at 800-642-1234. John, we're going to look more at the data, but you and your colleagues in this piece highlight the stories. You talk to survivors of someone who had lost someone to COVID-19. What kind of stories did you hear from people?
Well, they're really heartbreaking stories. And I think it's important to remember that, I did mention this thing about the cause of death. There is, even though the age of a lot of the people, including who we talked about here, they're older, but they were still living. If they had underlying health conditions, they were still living and probably going to live for years to come. So I think of the case of Diane Romano Brown. She's a retired hospice nurse, and she and her longtime partner were, just really spending a very quiet summer around the backyard of their house. She's retired and was being very careful and thinks that they got COVID when, she went on an errand to get some vitamins and died, very quickly after that, once she got to the hospital and went into distress. There's the case of James Banks, who was a very popular tavern owner in Milwaukee and had mentored young men for years, really, who would come into his establishment. And also Diane Butler. And this is like just a woman who really carried her family on her shoulders and was just there sort of that person in a family who really around which everything seems to circulate. And so talking to these families and my colleagues, Sophie Carson and Irene Chang, were just talked to these families, and their contributions were just vital to the story. Because I think in the data we can look at the data and look at it, and it's important to do that, but absent the lives and the intimate stories that families are sharing, they don't have that meaning of what really was lost in this year.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Whitewater. Paul, hi.
Hello. I'm calling because I've heard that the flu season has virtually been non-existent this year, the standard flu. And, of course, people do die from that. I don't know what the number of flu deaths are in Wisconsin on average, but I suspect that there are rather few this year because of the much reduced numbers of cases. Have you removed that number of the number of flu deaths which did not occur from your statistics, because it should increase the number of people who will die of COVID-19.
Paul, yeah, thanks for the call. Oh, go ahead, John. Yeah,
no, that's a good point. And we did see that. We saw the flu season come to an abrupt halt when people started staying home and not just not moving around as much last year. And we've had essentially no flu season to date. In terms of in Wisconsin, the number of flu deaths are fairly negligible compared to COVID deaths. We're talking low triple digits. So in the, between 100 and 120 is what it's run in the last 10 years. But we're talking about now it's single digits. It was below 10 the last time I saw. So it is a factor to consider. It certainly could be. Factored into some of the unexplained deaths or those moved over to other categories. But that was one of the questions that people had is would COVID sort of be borrowing or be miscategorized as the flu deaths? And so flu is a killer. It's not as significant a killer as we saw COVID as a cause of death. But Paul, you're exactly right. It completely stopped last year about this time. And then through this season, there's been virtually no flu season.
Thanks for the call, Paul. We're talking to John Diedrich, investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about their deep dive into a year's worth of COVID-19 data and who it impacted the most. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember doing or feeling in those early months when the cases first began here in the state? Do you have questions or concerns about what we've learned over the last year from this data? And did you lose someone close to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with John Diedrich, investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about what we can learn from the state's COVID-19 data from the last year. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences over the last year. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John, I want to dig into something you referenced earlier. We saw early on racial disparities in who was impacted by COVID-19 here in Wisconsin. What do we know a year later?
Well, it's interesting. So when we look at the first sort of round of deaths that happened in Milwaukee County and in the state of Wisconsin, we saw huge disproportionate numbers of particularly African-American residents who were dying. The 21 of the first 25 people in Milwaukee County who died were African-American. And so the question was, would that continue? And it did continue to some degree, not at that level, but through summer. And what's interesting in fall is we started to see those numbers change a little bit. And the reason, as we went through, if you look at the data right now, just based on the population in Milwaukee County and in the state, it would appear that there is no health disparity or there's no disparity for African-American, Latino, and so forth. In other words, the deaths are matching the population. The problem with that straight comparison, and it's false, actually, there is a disparity, because what you have to do, and we did this for our piece, was you have to adjust for age. And just a side note, the number one factor of why people die or why they have died of COVID-19 in 2020 is age. It outstrips every other factor. 80% of the deaths are people who are 70 and over. So your older populations need to be accounted for in that case. And so when you adjust our racial groups and ethnic groups for age, what happens is that disparity reappears. And it's really important to do that because in Milwaukee County, for instance, we tend to have an older white population. So you would expect more white deaths because age is the indicator of serious illness and death from COVID-19. African-Americans are younger and Latinos are younger yet. And so we factored all that in and the disparity still exists. And it's not as strong as it was early on. But the other factor to consider here is not only do we have a white population that's older in Milwaukee County, but it also lives in nursing homes in a far higher numbers than African Americans and Latinos, partially because of their age, they get older, and just socioeconomics. And as we know, that has been the single largest site of COVID deaths or residential settings have been nursing homes. And so that would explain why the white population, it took some time, but COVID-19 hit that population well. But again, the disparity when you adjust for age is clear there for the racial and ethnic groups.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, I just tuned in and you may have addressed this. My concern is about the data, the statistics on the Native American reservations within the border of Wisconsin. How were those vaccines distributed? Because those families tend to live, multi-generations in one home. And how were they affected and what do we know about that? Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. In this piece, you didn't get so much into the vaccine distribution, John. And do we have data broken out for Native American groups here in Wisconsin?
We do. And it's a small population relative to the rest of the population, but it's been hit very hard, especially in the fall. And by state data, and again, this is just on per capita. And so it gets even greater when adjusted for age, that Native American people in Wisconsin have been hardest hit as a group. Again, their percentage of deaths is higher than proportionally than their population, and more than Latino, more than African American, and certainly a lot more than white. And that was interesting that we didn't see that early on. And there's just sort of endless theories about why spread happens and what kicked it off, and COVID, sort of pandemic fatigue, and is it masks, how they're being used, gatherings, schools, there's lots of different elements to kind of control for it. But what we could see was that there was a clear increase in fall, and that was one of the areas. And we had some reporting around the vaccine efforts. We've had a whole team at our paper doing that, and there has been a big push now because of that disparate effect on the American Indian population in Wisconsin to get the vaccine delivered. And again, especially because housing situations. And so, it's important to protect the most vulnerable in that, especially when you have different generations who might be at different spots of life.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to John Diedrich from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at a year of information now on COVID-19 and what we've learned, who was hit hardest. John, you mentioned that peak in Wisconsin. It was really November. And one of the experts you talked to talked about, you didn't want the peak at all, but better in November than earlier on in the pandemic. We'd learned more about it. We had some treatment techniques that helped. Talk about the fact that was delayed and we had more time to get ready.
Well, that's exactly right. So you think about where the peak really hit New York City, like early on. And at that point, you remember early on, we were thinking about, okay, get people on ventilators. And, and as we went on, we learned that if you could avoid that possibility, you wanted to avoid that because the outcomes were not good. Once somebody was vented for a period of time, their muscles atrophied and they became vent dependent and died. So the survival rate weren't as good. We saw certain drugs that surfaced and it's like had promising, impacts. And then it's like, no, that's not really going to work as well. Other stuff came in that some of it actually, like routine drugs that are highly common, like steroids and things of that nature, that turned out to be helpful. And then basic things like, turning patients on their stomachs and abdomens and getting the pressure off that way was another technique. So, the healthcare system for us, sort of a blessing as it came through the country is we had a little bit of time. If you go back, we had sort of a mini surge there in April, May, and then it just kind of was quiet. And then September came. There's a lot of, study that's gone on into what prompted it. Was it school? Was it some combination of school and fatigue and so forth? But it was really clear in the numbers in September. And then we saw the deaths following in October. But again, by that time, we had some indications of what was going to be helpful and what was not. in that front. And so in that way, we may have had the case fatality rate in Wisconsin stands right at about 1%. These are the confirmed cases and then the confirmed deaths. And, you know, that has come down over time. And what the experts I spoke to said is it certainly their view is it certainly would have been higher had we gotten November's surge in, say, April.
Let's bring on one more caller. Scott is with us in Wanakee. Scott, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up, Scott?
Early in the pandemic, there were stories going around about how long the virus lived on certain surfaces, metal, plastic, cloth, etc. And some of those stories were conflicting. And, it made it sound like somebody had actually done studies, which seems like easy enough to do and certainly repeatable enough to do. But yet, the question remains now, what is the current understanding and where did those numbers come from back then?
Scott, thanks for the call. I remember studies, John, but I think the finding over time was the surfaces weren't the important thing. It was the airborne transmission.
That's right. And we had this virus and everything around has probably been studied more than, I don't know, just about anything in recent time for us. And so there was a real demand for sort of instant analysis. And a lot of those studies, some of them have been not these particular studies, but studies on COVID did not go through the normal peer review process. And that made sense because it was like people needed information as quickly as possible. But you're exactly right, Rob, that there was an understanding that airborne was the most important thing to keep in mind. I think there's still a thinking that there could be a transmission depending on where you touch your eyes, nose, ear, that sort of stuff with a surface. But the idea of person to person and airborne is where the greatest risk is right now. And it is interesting. I mean, we still see cleaning going on in surfaces and so forth. But it does seem to have backed off more, and the focus that I see now, is just more on techniques to eliminate the airborne transmission or mitigate it.
Thanks for that call. And John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
John Diedrich is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was part of the reporting team for a piece that looked at the COVID-19 data and demographics from over the last year. You can find a link to that extensive piece at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll turn our attention skyward and look at how some of the most famous stars have shaped our understanding of the universe. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, the Bears are back in town. Not the Chicago ones. We'll find out how Wisconsin's Bears are gearing up for spring after a long winter rest. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, when we look up at the night sky, there are plenty of stars to see and trillions of others that we can't. The sheer scale of the universe can be overwhelming, but by zeroing in on a star here and a nebula there, astronomers have spent the past few thousand years getting a better idea of how space works and where we are in it. Our next guest turns his lens to some of the most famous stars and how they've provided the key for answering big questions about the universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a stargazer? Do you have a favorite star or maybe one that helps guide you when you look at the night sky? What interests you the most about the different types of stars we can see? And what questions do you have about how we know what we know about stars, what they're made of, where they are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Giles Sparrow is a science writer whose latest book is A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and 3 Imposters. Giles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Vope. Thanks for having me.
Well, trillions of stars out there, as I said. How did you narrow it down to pick the stars of your book?
Well, it's although there's there's about 200 billion stars in the Milky Way and about 200 billion galaxies in the universe that we can see. But we're kind of lucky that they kind of fall into categories. So you can, a lot of, one star can stand for an awful lot of them. And the stars pass through various different stages in their lives, and depending on how much material they've got inside them, they can evolve down different pathways. But I looked at this, I've had this idea of doing a book like this for many years, and I kind of thought, okay, how many can I boil it down to? And that's where I kind of came up with the figure of 21 from. And I thought, okay, well, now I need to find like the best representatives of these different stars, and ideally ones that you can see in the night sky without any special equipment, just with the naked eye or with binoculars.
And part of what I love about the book is that the stars you picked are don't just tell their own story, but also the story about how we here on Earth started to learn more about stars, what they were, and how far away they were. And let's start there with the star 61 Cygni, or do I say 61 Cygni? I don't know.
I say 61.
61, me too. Great. How that one helped us figure out how far away stars were, because that was a wide open question for millennia.
Well, it was, yeah. It was one of the things when they first figured out that the Earth must be orbiting around the sun, one of the arguments that people used to push back against it was, well, if the Earth is moving around the sun instead of staying still in the middle of the universe, then why don't we see the star? Why doesn't our point of view of the stars change from like one half of the years with the other? Because if you think, if we're moving hundreds of millions of miles from one side of our orbit around the sun to the other, then you'd kind of expect that our point of view of the stars would shift. And just the same as if you kind of hold your finger out at the end of your arm and then squinted it through one eye and then the other, it seems to move against the background. And so they eventually, you know, people said, well, it must be because the stars are even further away than we can imagine. So we don't see these, you know, we don't see these shifts, but they're there. And it took a long time for them to figure this out, a couple of hundred years. So people kept on trying and failing to find it until like the 1830s or so. And eventually they worked out, there was this star 61 Cygni, which is in the constellation of the Swan, which is a summer, you can see it on summer nights, not so much at this time of year, but it's not a particularly significant star. But one thing they had noticed about it was that it moves across the sky quite rapidly. And all the stars obviously drift across the sky in the course of the night as the Earth rotates underneath them. But some stars actually move in relation to the other stars very gradually. But this one, in comparison to a lot of the others, it was moving at a tremendous pace. I mean, when I say that, it's like only covering the width of a full moon every few hundred years. But that was enough for them to call it the flying star. And they figured, well, if that one appears to be moving so fast, then maybe it's really close to us. And so they eventually managed to measure the view, measure what angle it was at from when they looked at it from Earth on one side of its orbit and on the other side. And they got this tiny little shift in the angle that they could see. And from that, it's fairly straightforward maths, because you know the distance from one side of Earth's orbit to the other, to then work out exactly how far it is, how far away it is. And it turned out to be just over 10 light years away, which means that based on its brightness, it's a star, or a pair of stars, in fact, that are about half the brightness of the sun. But this was really the first hint or confirmation that other stars really were other suns, fairly like our own.
Talking to Giles Sparrow about his new book, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and 3 Imposters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a backyard stargazer with the naked eye, binoculars, telescopes, you name it, tell us what you like to look for at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. One thing that kind of blows my mind, Giles, and this comes up a few times through the book, we look back at the ancient Greeks, for example, and their observations. Their night sky might have been different than our night sky because the tilt of the Earth has changed. So things that they might have been able to see things now that only the southern hemisphere could see nowadays.
Yes, it's one of these funny effects that most people know that the North, the Pole Star Polaris, sits directly in line with Earth's North Pole. And so it's the one star that doesn't move through the night. And that's because although Earth's axis is tilted compared to like straight up in the sky by about 23 degrees, and that stays pointing at the same general direction in space towards Polaris all the way through the year as the Earth orbits the sun, it kind of spins around, but it doesn't change the orientation of the poles. So that's what gives us the seasons. But because the moon's it's actually due to the moon's gravity tugging slightly at Earth's equator, the direction that the pole points in does change very, very slowly over about 26,000 years. And that means that the direction of the star that's the center point of the sky, as it were, the pivot point, that tracks around over 26,000 years. And sometimes it's just pointing at empty space. In a few thousand years' time, it'll be pointing at a star called Vega, which is one of the brightest stars in the sky. It's in the constellation of Lyra. And so that changes. And because the range of other stars that you can see and how far south in the sky you can see is related to where this central pivot point is, that brings other stars into view at different times.
Let's talk about another star you feature here. Now, we can look and we can see the stars even from the ground here. We can see they have different colors, different levels of brightness. And that could tell us a lot. It was a big part of the birth of astrophysics. One star you focus on is Aldebaran in the Taurus constellation. How does that fit into the story?
Yeah, it's that's a really bright one. It's an easy one to spot. If you go out anytime around now and have a clear night, you can see the constellation of the Bull Taurus will be in the southwest after sunset. And it's pretty prominent because it's got this V-shaped face. There's a star cluster called the Hyades. And Aldebaran is the brightest star in that cluster or in front of that cluster. And it makes the eye of the bull. And it was the first star where they really analyzed its light by splitting it through a device. It's called a diffraction grating, but basically it works the same as a prism, a glass prism. So it splits up light into all of its different colors according to the wavelength and the energy that the light contains. And so this was the very first star that they tried this with. They'd done it with the sun. A guy called Josef von Fraunhofer did that in the early 1800s. But it was it wasn't until the 1860s that they really had the technology and telescopes had come on enough to get this to work. And they found that there were these dark lines across the face. When you spread out the light, it's a red star, so you find that there's a lot of red lights and some yellow lights and some whitish light in the middle, but not much sort of blue light or hotter higher temperatures. But the colors have got these dark lines in front of them, which is, they figured out, is where different chemicals that are in the star's atmosphere are absorbing the energy at specific wavelengths, because every chemical has its fingerprints, if you like, that it's a particular types of light that it gives out or absorbs depending based on its atomic structure. And that's like a unique print that you can use to trace the chemicals in the atmospheres of stars, and Aldebaran was the very first one that they did it on. They went on to do it on millions and millions of others.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to author Giles Sparrow about his new book, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and 3 Imposters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the night sky? If you are a stargazer yourself, tell us about what you do, where you go to do it. Do you have a favorite star or one that you use to find your way in the night sky? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Giles Sparrow, author of the book A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and Three Imposters. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Rhinelander. John, hi.
I worked for the science laboratory of GE Medical for 5 years, and we would call that machine a spectroscoper to sort out the different light waves of different atoms. I have a question and a comment for your guest. How many times hotter is the sun than it takes to melt steel? And a comment is, if we can see so many galaxies by our naked eye, how many can we see with a telescope?
Wow. Okay, John, you gave us a lot to work with there. Giles, the heat of suns, of stars, well, it depends on the star, I guess, but more than hot enough to melt steel, I should think.
Oh, yes, definitely. And the sun's temperature is about 10,000 Fahrenheit, roughly. Thinking, I'm having to convert, being a Brit, I kind of think in Celsius most of the time.
Fair enough.
But I think the melting point is like carbon steel is about 2,700 Fahrenheit or so. So I guess the sun's, at a crude guess, you know, the sun is about four times hotter than the temperature it takes to melt steel. And and the sun is quite average, you know, for a star in terms of its temperature. You can get stars that have got temperatures of up to, you know, 80,000 Fahrenheit or so. Some of the really hot blue and, you know, blue-white ones.
And then John asked about galaxies, and that's one of your three imposters in the book, the Andromeda Galaxy, which people thought, is it a star? Is it a nebula? So how many galaxies like that can we see just, on a clear night in an unlit area versus how many we're picking up, maybe with just a backyard telescope? I know an orbital telescope can get a lot more.
Yes, yeah. On a clear night, you can see, I think, if you really push the limits of what you're, you know, I've heard reports of people being able to see maybe three or four of the nearby spiral galaxies. Andromeda is very definitely the only one that you can see quite prominently with the naked eye. It's kind of a middle. It looks like a middle ranking fuzzy star, if you know where to look for it. And when you look through binoculars or something like that, you see it's this kind of lens-shaped glowing ball of light. And if you're in the southern hemisphere, you can see the two patches called the Magellanic Clouds, which look like outlined bits of the Milky Way, but are actually other galaxies that are in orbit around ours, but they're much smaller. And there's only really another couple of spirals where I've ever heard reports of people seeing them with their naked eyes. So it's really a handful. But on the other hand, that means if you look at Andromeda, you're looking at something, the light that's hitting the back of your eyeball is stuff that it left 2.5 million years ago and has traveled all the way across space to kind of be with us tonight. So it's quite a journey it's taken.
And one of the amazing things to me, Giles, is we've really only known about this whole galaxy thing for, what, about 100 years now?
Yes, yeah, it was, and there was quite a fierce debate before that. People were wondering, okay, is the Milky Way and the star, you know, all the stars and things, because everything we can see is, we now think of as part of our own, you know, as all the stars in the sky are really belong in our own galaxy. And people debated whether or not that was the full extent of it, and they wondered what these other fuzzy objects in the sky were. And then eventually, using the spectroscope, as your caller had the right terminology, they they worked out that some of them were made of gas, and so mostly they shone like a neon lamp, and other ones appeared to be made up of countless stars. So they then started wondering, okay, are these, you know, are these things that are quite nearby in orbit around the Milky Way, or are they immensely distant, and are they Island universes was the term that they liked to use at the time to describe what might be other galaxies. And eventually, a very clever lady called Henrietta Swan Leavitt came up with this a method for measuring the distance of stars that would actually work even when you're looking at these vast distances of intergalactic space, because she figured out that there's a certain group of variable stars, which are stars that pulsate in light. They give out more light at some times and less at the other, less at others, and they kind of pulsate over a few days, roughly. And she worked out there was a link between the rate at which these things pulsated and their intrinsic brightness, the actual how fiercely the star was burning. And so once she knew that, another chap, Edwin Hubble, after whom the telescope is named, then took that discovery, and he very carefully looked at the Andromeda Galaxy and photographed it, you know, continuously, and eventually was able to track down that there were some of these pulsating stars there. And so he painstakingly measured the time that they were taking to change and how long the period of variation was. And from that, he was able to work out, okay, if these are Cepheids, the same as the ones that Henrietta Leavitt had discovered in and around the Milky Way, then they must be a certain luminosity. And given how faint they appear from Earth, they would have to be 2 million or more light years away.
Thanks for that call. We'll bring on Kimberly now in Fox Lake. Kimberly, hi.
Hi. So one of my favorite stars has always been Betelgeuse, and I'm not sure if you covered it in your book, but I didn't know if you knew much about that or had any interesting facts about that star.
Kimberly, thanks for the call. Giles, you do. It is one of your 21 stars. We just have a couple minutes left. Give us a little bit about Betelgeuse.
I do indeed, yeah. Betelgeuse is amazing. It's a red giant star. It's on the shoulder of Orion, the constellation of the Hunter, which, again, you can see at this time of year. Go out and you'll see he kind of stands there, and he's facing off against Taurus, the bull. So he's quite prominent. And Betelgeuse is a red supergiant. It's a dying star that's got a lot more mass than the sun. And due to instability inside, most stars through their lives, they shine by burning hydrogen in their cores and turning that into helium. But as they get older, they run out of hydrogen, and they go to increasingly desperate measures to keep on shining by burning heavier and heavier elements. And this makes the star unstable. And so it brightens up, but it also balloons enormously in size. And so that actually cuts down the amount of energy that's heating up any particular part of the surface. And so that's why they appear red. And yeah, it's one of the few stars that we've been able to actually measure. If you've got a powerful enough telescope, you can, yeah, and I'm talking about space telescopes here, it's one of the few stars that you can actually see that it's something other than a single point of light in the sky, because it's that immense that you can actually detect its extended atmosphere around it.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Giles, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to science writer Giles Sparrow. His latest book is called A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and 3 Imposters. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly roundup of the top stories in national politics, including the latest on Senate confirmations, the filibuster, and more. Some Wisconsin lawmakers say we need term limits for members of Congress. We'll look at the pros and cons of limited terms in the U.S. House and Senate, and you can join in with your thoughts. A drug company at the center of lawsuits in the opioid epidemic has offered up a new settlement plan. We'll check out their offer and the role that drug companies have played in the ongoing opioid problem. Plus, Wisconsin poets tackled life during the pandemic in a new book out this month. We'll take a look at the new anthology, Sheltering with Poems. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's gotten colder and snowier over the last couple of days, but before that, we had a taste of spring-like weather. If you're like me, you are filled with joy at the warm temperatures and with fear for the looming return of allergy season. It turns out today marks a big anniversary in allergy history. On this day in 1819, a British researcher published the first modern clinical description of what we now know as seasonal allergies. He didn't discover them. I think people have been experiencing them for thousands of years. As reported by the BBC, John Bostock shared the story of a patient referred to as J.B. Age 46, J.B. was, quote, of a spare and rather delicate habit, but capable of considerable exertion. J.B. was the researcher himself, John Bostock. He described his symptoms: a sensation of heat and fullness in the eyes, a slight degree of redness in the eyes and a discharge of tears, and sneezing, tightness of the chest, and difficulty in breathing. That sounds about right. He raised the possible connection to the seasonal grasses grown in England and noted that people referred to a kind of hay fever associated with the rise of hay crops in springtime. A common cure for the condition, many people in England anyway at the time, if they could afford it, would escape to the seaside. They thanked the sea air for their cure, but they were really just getting away from all the pollen. Well, there's my solution: 3 months on the beach this year. Just run that past my boss. I'm sure it won't be a problem. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.